the show.
Well, hey everyone, and welcome to this week's show. I'm your host, Lisa Anderson. Great to have you with us this week. And we're going to jump right into our roundtable. Obviously, we have our Q&A coming up, and then we've got a great interview with Steve Saccone on relational intelligence. So the whole theme this week is kind of along the lines of friendship and relationship and communication, and how do you make it all work, and how do you not be fake in the midst of it all. So, but we're going to talk a little bit in our roundtable today on the topic of, I'll just say, first off, kind of like that social awkwardness. So naturally, I had to bring into the studio Martha, Travis, and Doug.
What?
Because
awkward.
That is awkward. That's my just direct nature, just calling y'all. It was just an intervention waiting to happen. No, I'm just teasing. Martha's here. Hey, Martha.
We actually put a lot of thought into our guests on the show. It's not because they're socially awkward, but they provide different insights and skills in this arena. So,
yeah.
That's kind. Martha, I actually feel very awkward.
Yeah. You're not awkward, Travis. We have Travis with us. Travis, back again in the seat. Great to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
Very fun. And Doug Tharp is also a return guest. Doug is now our assistant pastor of young adults here at Village 7 Press in town. So also providing a church perspective on this, because where do relational issues crop up but in the church?
Hopefully I won't get fired for what I say.
We hope not. We won't. We'll just, your segment is just going to be like, beep. We're going to bleep out things. Yeah. We're going to just bleep out comments and names and all kinds of stuff. So it'll be good.
Swear words.
Exactly. Whoa. Yeah, exactly.
Okay, good.
So, okay. So this is going to be kind of a, we're going to hit a number of different things here. So the first thing I want to just say is kind of lay it out there is, like I said, we're talking about friendship. Everyone wants to be a friend. Everyone wants friends. But somehow it just is like difficult. It's like, don't you remember when you were younger and like the kids that you wanted to be your friends, they didn't want to be your friends? Uh-uh. It was all the other kids that you didn't want as friends, okay?
What?
So it was like...
That wasn't my case, but...
Okay.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Lisa's self-projection tour.
No. But you know, it was just like there was always this jockeying for position. And then in junior high, it was like you were only worth anything if people wrote you notes. And it was just always this big game. And it was very difficult. And some kids were shy. And some kids always got moved around into different schools. And it was always hard breaking in. So we kind of still live some of that, I think, even as young adults, and it's a little bit tricky to navigate. But I want to talk a little bit first about friendship in general, and just the idea of, we know that not everyone has to be the life of the party. There's not, you know, we don't all need to be extroverts. You don't all need to be super suave or have all these great jokes up your sleeve or super great sense of humor. But you have to have some kind of skills. And when you think of that, when you think of the people that have relational skills, know how to be good friends, know how to be in groups and work with people and see people and listen to people, what do you think of? What does that mean to you? Or what have you tried to aspire to, maybe I should say, as you've tried to be a friend?
I can think of one girl in my small group who was just very intentional to single people out of saying, hey, Martha, how are you? How's your week going? And she'll make a point to talk to every person. I'm just always impressed of, she's not as worried about where am I going to sit or, you know, I don't know. She just makes time for everybody. So that really stands out.
Mm-hmm. I think Martha's exactly right in that it comes down to more who you are as far as your intentionality with other people rather than who you want to be to other people. Mm-hmm. Because you can, by all means, you know, want to be authentic with someone, and someone that's really, really authentic and really, really honest can just be annoying and smothering. Mm-hmm. Or you can also be really superficial and be really successful and hip and cool and popular, but that's not what really, you know, if you want to use the expression, wins friends. What really wins friends is your receptiveness and understanding of the people around you and the way that you engage them authentically.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with both of you guys, and it's a fine line in that you can't fake it. I mean, I guess you can try and fake it till you make it, but there's got to be a piece in you that you look at another person almost more important than yourself. I think that's one of the key principles, is actually be genuinely interested in other people. Because kind of like you were saying, when you're a kid sitting on the sandbox and you're sitting there hoping that other kids are going to come your way, and then automatically, if I tell a funny joke, that all the friends are going to like come my way, that usually doesn't happen. Mm-hmm. Usually, the way that people start having friends is that they are more interested in somebody else rather than themselves.
Yeah.
We'll talk more about these principles as we go along. Ladies and gentlemen, wouldn't you
say, just from your experience, and I know certainly in the church, Doug, I think you'd agree that still as 20 and 30 somethings, I mean, people sit there and they go to a church for like 3 weeks and then they're like, no one talked to me. No one became my friend. No one did this or that. Mm-hmm. So I'm just done. And so they move on to the next. And it's always about like, what are people, are people approaching me? Are people asking about me? Are people, you know, and I'm like, isn't it a two-way street? Kind of thing.
That's exactly right. In fact, it gets to the point where you'll have people say, well, you know what? I was sitting here for a while and it just wasn't working. And so I wanted to test you guys. I wanted to see how you really feel about me. So I moved over here to really see, you know, well, are these people going to latch on to me? And again, exactly like you said, what I want to ask them is, well, what were you doing during that time? You know, is it really all about your kingdom, your wants, your selfishness? Or is it about I'm at church to take the love of God and share it with people around me. And so I want to know them and I want to love them more than I want to be here to be served by the church. Mm-hmm.
But in that case, somebody who, let's say, has been with the church for a long time and you do have a visitor and you reach out and you want to make a friend right away, if you reached out and just simply said, hi, my name's Travis, I want to hear more about your story, all of a sudden that person who's an outsider has an insider view and they're connected. And it's because one person within the group got out of their comfort zone and said, hey, I'd like to talk to you a little bit more. Mm-hmm. But the reverse could be true. That person who's on the outside can just as easily go to somebody who's on the inside and say, hi, my name's Joe. I'd like to learn a little bit more about this church. And all of a sudden, the ball starts rolling and you start making some friends.
Yeah. I think even your body language and giving eye contact and smiling at people, that's an important first step, too, that you can't ignore.
Principle number two, smile.
Travis is smiling right now, and we feel that he's so much friendlier toward us as a result.
That's right. That's smile. Great.
As long as it's not a creepy smile.
Yeah.
Sorry about that.
Practice. Yeah. You want to practice in front of the mirror.
Practice the non-creepy smile.
If you could see my smile pleasant. Over the podcast.
Nice.
Yeah.
Okay, so we know what that looks like or what is ideal as far as that, you know, how it plays out. How do you see this happening then in relationships? Like how, I mean, because I, for example, one thing that, you know, I always tell people at church, I'm not ashamed of doing, and whenever we have new people come into our Sunday school class, I'm always like, you got to nab them and we've got to ask them out to lunch. Like, that's the way of like luring them in. Because as soon as you bring people out to lunch, you get to know them, you spend some time with them, you invite them to maybe something that night or something that week, they come to that. Then it's kind of like you can't give people the brush off after that. You know, you can brush people off after just sitting in their Sunday school class or whatever, but it's like, oh, no, I talked to you about your life. You're not just ditching me now, okay? You know? So it does. I mean, I think it comes back to that kind of that investment as it plays out. But why do we see then, whether it's in singles groups or whether it's in small groups or Bible studies or just, you know, social groups, kind of this weird, what are some of the dynamics that we see then play out that we would call awkwardness?
I think one of the main things you see are people either over-eager to please everyone around them, and so they're the kind that are just going to jump in and, you know, try to tell you their entire life story, maybe be overly blunt with you, overly honest, latch on to you, and it really becomes, again, about them, where they're trying to, you know, raise their self-esteem by saying, see, people do like me, I can fit in, kind of thing. And that can become really awkward, you know, when you're trying to have a conversation with someone else and you've got someone breathing like Darth Vader over your shoulder, trying to get into the conversation because they're really eager. That's right. Problematic. But then you also have the fringe dwellers who come at the last second, leave as soon as they can, and they're really afraid of opening up because they're afraid they're going to get hurt. And both are issues of self-esteem, which are really pride issues of saying, you know, I'm more concerned about what people think of me, whether it's liking me or being hurt by them, than being willing to just be real and listen when I have the opportunity and really get to know them.
Mm-hmm. Kind of with that point is, you know, one of the things that somebody was bringing out about going out to lunch. Mm-hmm. I like that, Lisa, and that to have like unawkward relationships, you really have to look at the other person and make them feel important, that you're important enough that I want to go and have a meal with you. And again, it's not about me. It's not about what I want to get. But the end result, you'll benefit with friends and have friends. But you got to think about them. You're important. and you need to eat, so let's go eat. Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah. I mean, we all appreciate that when somebody takes the initiative and you all of a sudden walk away going, wow, this is cool. I feel like somebody gets me, especially in a church context.
Yeah. Well, and there are people that are just known for that. Like I've heard Bill Hybels talk about John Maxwell in that sense. And he said, you never leave John Maxwell's presence without having felt like your life was added to or your character was added to. And John would always find a specific way to build someone up with a word or encouragement or some compliment about them or whatever. And I think that's important for us to practice doing more often, you know, to build into people and to do that. But now what? Okay, so let's look at the church scenario again. Because where do you find the balance in? It seems like the church often will attract needy people and hurting people. Mm-hmm. And we are no strangers to people who are needy and hurting. I mean, the world is full of them, and they're not only in the church, but we've got them in the church. So the needy people, for example, will tend to congregate, and maybe they'll end up, say that they end up in a singles group. How do you balance? Because sometimes those people will gravitate towards those same people who really are kind and giving and want to be helpful and want to be Christ-like. But those people can't take on everyone, and they can't take them on at every minute of their life. So how do you deal with that?
I mean, obviously, what you're bringing up, Lisa, are just kind of two different people. So you've got those that are wanting to have friends, and now you've flipped the switch. You're the person that you want to be. You're friendly to other people, and then it's attracting. That now you've got a friend problem, in a sense, which is a good problem to have. That all these people look to you as your friend, but you're just one person. So how can you manage all the neediness of them when they haven't fully accepted the principles of being a friend in return? And I think that is really a key. That if you're going to engage in those kind of needy relationships, which we're all needy to a certain degree, that you are grounded in Christ and you have the strength and maturity to handle that, number one. I think you have to have some maturity and understand and begin thinking of a discipleship and going, you know what, I've got to set some boundaries. And the way that I treat these folks that are very needy in our small group or whatever is going to set a precedent in their life. And so how do I help set a good example and not let them push that so that they're not calling you? I mean, there's a difference between, hey, you know what, call me at any time, you know, you need a friend, to every night at 2 a.m., ring, hey, man, yeah, I'm still struggling with this again. I mean, that's like setting those boundaries and helping set them up for success, coming up with a discipleship plan, and helping them have their own certain friends where they're leading somebody else. Mm-hmm. If you could get them kind of flipping that switch a little bit, will help them start to recognize what it is that the drain that they're probably being.
Well, I don't think
you.
Everyone needs to be your best friend. Mm-hmm. You know, there's different categories of people. So maybe it's just a matter of encouraging them in things that they are involved in, or just helping them with their self-esteem, just through encouragement and asking questions, listening.
Mm-hmm. And I think there are definitely differences. I mean, I think there are people that have, you know, genuine struggles or just really are needy people, have issues, you know, whether it's physiological or just, you know, real bona fide issues.
Yeah.
I mean, so I think that's for sure, for real. And obviously, you know, there's a lot to do about that and a lot we can be in that kind of situation. But what about, you know, and this is kind of turning the table a little bit, is what about the people that just really need to be told something?
Yeah.
One
of the first things I thought is, you know, in addition to all this great advice, and I really like the idea of establishing boundaries and that sort of thing, but you also have to watch out. There are genuine creepers in groups, particularly singles groups, right? There are creepers around.
Creepers!
Exactly. And so I think that's where, as a group, whatever it is, whether it's a Bible study or a Sunday morning community or whatever it is, there also has to be an understanding of, is there an authority that we can go to if something weird is happening? And if it's a mixed group, the guys really need to be looking out for the girls, and vice versa, because unfortunately, a lot of times those kinds of people that are really needy will often try to latch themselves on to someone of the opposite sex to fulfill their needs. Mm-hmm. And that can get you into a lot of bad places. And so I think also in dealing with those situations, yeah, you get into the principle of, you know, speaking the truth in love.
Right.
And there's a time for you to be loving and be Christ to them and serve them. But there's also time for you to say, look, you've got some serious problems. And particularly if you have someone protecting you so that you don't have to do that. If you have, you know, an elder, a mentor, a discipler in the community, or if it's a, you know, a girl latching onto the guys, one of the ladies can come over or vice versa. And I think that really can help establish those boundaries and do so in an appropriate way.
That's what's awesome about being a Christian, I think, is that if you don't have Christ in your life, it's difficult to find a boundary that's outside of the relationship. Mm-hmm. Is that we can always go to the scripture and say, brother, here's something that's scriptural. And it doesn't have to be a personal thing where, you know, outside of the church, it can be very personal. Oh, you did this, you did that. And hopefully as the body of Christ, we're trying to encourage and exhort one another. And if we can set that, those ground rules within those church relationships, within the small group setting, like, hey, guys, ultimately, here's the purpose. We want to grow in your relationship with Jesus. And that means we may have to get a little rough at times or share some truth, but understand it's not that we want to break the relationship. It's just we want you to have a better relationship with Christ.
Mm-hmm. It's funny because I am currently doing a management orientation here at Focus that all managers have to go through. And one of the things we discussed this morning was the whole idea of healthy conflict and what that looks like. And of course, everyone in the room says, well, we don't do that enough. We don't do it enough. Well, of course we don't do it enough because no one wants to be unliked and because no one wants to have to address hard things. But yet I think that the church is a perfect place where a lot of that does have to happen because there are some people that just don't have an awareness of maybe some issue. And I'm not even talking about people that are necessarily like, you know, creepers in the worst sense of the word, but people who are just honestly thinking, you know, okay, well, I'm fine. I don't know what's wrong. Like, why no one will date me or why no one, you know, what's happening? And really to, you know, kind of turn that mirror back and say, hey, there are a few things that you probably could work on.
Mm-hmm. I think that's where self-examination is important too, you know, and self-examination, I don't mean psychoanalyzing yourself, but reflecting the scriptures upon yourself and thinking, you know, am I one of these people? And like you said, it's not necessarily the creeper. It can be the person who, you know, in prayer request time, you have 15 minutes for prayer requests and they take 10 minutes every week. Mm-hmm. And they are well-intentioned and they are trying to do the right thing and they're trying to share their life with you. But what they're not understanding is they're monopolizing that time and it actually is annoying people because of that. And so how do you communicate that with them and how are they able to be perceptive to, wait a minute, am I causing a problem here?
Right.
Mm-hmm. I've written that down here as an example, not having a sense of taking someone's time because a lot of people will monopolize conversations and then talking too much just generally or always one-upping someone in a conversation, people that are too direct, people that are too sarcastic. I think that was one of my things that probably in the last, I don't know, like 5 or 6 years maybe even, I've grown in is recognizing that sometimes I would be very, because I knew what was going on in my head and I knew that I was just being funny and I knew that I really loved the person. So I would make some totally sarcastic comment, not realizing, you know, even if it was in a group, not realizing that it was probably much more cutting than I intended it. And the other person took it very poorly. But for me, it was just like, oh, no, I totally don't think that of you. That's why, you know, I would always say, no, it's just hyperbole. And then I had to realize, wow, no, you don't need to always just be so sarcastic about everything. So I've had to really tone that down. But I don't know, any other like self-awareness things y'all have had to come up with or learn?
I mean, I think we all struggle with that wanting to be right as well. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's, you know, I'm right, you're wrong, and this is the way it's going to be. And that puts up huge barriers and create, and that's one thing I struggle with is, you know, you think you have a right idea, and you may be right, but we sometimes don't think in terms of actually winning, if you will. We want the other person's buy-in. We want them to embrace our ideas or our thoughts or patterns. But when we come at it with those kind of angles of, oh, I'm right, you're wrong, automatically the only response is for somebody else to be defensive. I mean, really, because nobody ever wants to be wrong. Very seldom will we ever admit that we're wrong. And so making somebody feel stupid is something I've had to, and I still have to work on. But
and then ultimately stopping and thinking, you know what? What do I really want to do? Yes, I want to be right in one sense, but ultimately, I want, you know, God's purpose is to prevail, which I'm going to call winning, and make something, you know, have something beautiful happen rather than just be right and be alone. Because you can be right and be alone.
I would agree with Travis. I like to be right as well. But my reaction usually is more of holding back, of not necessarily jumping in because, I don't know, do I really have something to add to that conversation or like storytelling? Oh, I need help with that. So I don't know. I think that could provide some awkwardness sometimes of not having the confidence to jump in and join the conversation.
One of the ways that both of those scenarios I think can actually win is to listen. Martha said it earlier, is that listening is so golden. Listening to somebody else, whether you think you're right or you think you're right, but you don't understand the other person or you want to have some influence. And if you just even in relationship, if you go up to somebody and say, you know what, tell me more about what you're thinking with that. I want to help understand. I mean, you know, Franklin Covey, if you look at the principles of highly successful people, you know, seek to understand before seeking to be understood. Listening. I mean, these are principles that are business principles. They're biblical principles. In fact, if you look in Proverbs, I was just skimming through the Proverbs, and you'll find so much that's talking about holding your tongue, listening to the other person. Don't jump the gun, because that'll show that you're a fool. I mean, so principle number three, listen.
And I think another type we could identify is what I call the Naomi syndrome. And that is, you know, woe is me. Everything about my life is bad. You know, changing my name to bitter, basically. And they're the, you know, they're the kind that maybe it is the silent bitterness. There's always a scowl on their face. Or maybe it's every time it's time to share, it's time to share about how horrible my life is compared to you and how much worse things are for me than they are for everyone around. And I think, again, the way you break that is to come back to what does the gospel say? What did Christ do that addresses that? And the theme that I've been thinking of through the gospels is, you know, a suffering servant. Mm-hmm. And what does it mean to be a suffering servant? Someone like Ruth compared to someone like Naomi. I'm bitter. I'm angry at God. And so really, what does it mean then in a small group, in a group of singles, to see yourself as a suffering servant for Christ rather than it's all about me?
Right. And these are dating principles too, y'all. I mean, we're talking in just terms of relationships. And I mean, obviously, but if you want to meet a guy or a girl, be interested. Like, you don't have to necessarily be interesting. I mean, we like to put things in those kind of terms, but be interested in other people. Listen to other people. As a gal, I can guarantee that if you... Oh, what is it?
That was point number four.
Oh, point in case you're following along with your little handout that we'll be distributing online.
Travis will be distributing.
Yeah. Yeah, but no, I mean, that, like, I mean, relationship, gals and guys. Guys, if you want to melt a girl's heart, listen to them. Shut up. Same thing with a girl. If you want to say, hey, tell me about your day, a guy will slowly start to open up. And if you get him talking, bam, you got some winning.
You know, there's something that I've noticed on online profiles, and obviously I just see guys, so I don't know what the women are saying, but guys that just everything in their profile is, I want this, and I want this, and I want this, and it's just like one laundry list of everything either that they like to do or that they want someone to ultimately do with them.
Where's the room for the person that they're looking for? It's just, hey, here's where I'm going. Come along. Yeah. Who cares really about you?
Exactly. And it better involve snowboarding.
But if you want to ride on this train, jump on board.
I mean, that's totally how it plays out.
Very few ladies find that attractive.
I would say
my
principle that I would add, can I add it as just a B subpoint to yours?
Subpoint B, yes.
Okay, subpoint B, is that you have to be able to cut people slack and laugh at yourself as well. Because, you know, so many people say so many different things and relate in so many different ways that you cannot necessarily claim to understand what everyone is trying to say and how they're trying to relate to you.
Totally.
So you have to be able to just let things go and understand that some things aren't as important as others, or sometimes people are going to like blurt out weird things, and not let it turn you into a Naomi or turn you into some kind of recluse or leave the church or the group altogether or something like that. Because I've seen that happen as well, and that can be dangerous and disappointing.
So
that's true. All right. Anything else to add?
laugh at yourself. That's good.
Well, I know.
That's a good point.
We have to add that to the list.
Just a sub-point.
Now we have a nice
Travis.
Round number oh, five. So,
point number five is that we're all human beings. We all have essential needs, and we all make mistakes. And that so even if you go out there and you really get interested, you're gonna make some mistakes. Other people are gonna make some mistakes. There's always gonna be relational awkwardness, I think. I mean, that's just part of that's just we're human beings, and so us as Christians, what can we do to become more and more the humans that God created mm-hmm. us to be, and recognize that where we're at may not be where somebody else is at. And so have some grace, have mm-hmm. some forgiveness, some flex in there, and you will be a likable person.
Okay, I always get this quote wrong because I never memorize it, but it's on everyone's Facebook page, and it's that one about be kind because everyone is facing a battle or something about that. Where's that from? I don't even know.
Yeah, I don't know.
Everyone uses it. Anyway, but I have thought about that a lot lately in just the sense that you don't know what people's pasts are. You don't know how people have been hurt. You don't know what their issues are and stuff like that. And I think there's so much truth to that because, you know, I came up from a relatively healthy home and both my parents loved each other. They loved me and stuff. And I look at people, I'm like, what is their problem? Goodness, why can't they just get it together? What is their issue? You know, just snap out of it. And, you know, and there are very real wounds that people are carrying. And some of, you know, people are in counseling, dealing with stuff. People have gotten massive baggage. People, you know, don't even have a sense of relationship in some ways because of stuff that they've dealt with. So I think that's an important thing to keep in mind as well as we deal with people. And most importantly, Travis, not to steal your thunder, but the most important point, can you underline this one for me, Travis?
Principle number six.
Number six, underlined, is that you have to have your identity in Christ, and have to be growing that. And as we always say, preach the gospel to yourself every day so that you understand who you truly are, so that everything else that's being defined about you out there is going to be, you're going to be able to just slough it off because if it's not truth. So,
amen.
Hallelujah.
And that's a privilege. And then, I mean, as Christians, that is a privilege. That is such a beautiful, beautiful thing. We have a solid rock to stand on.
Yeah, true. All right. Well, thanks to you all for being part of this conversation. This was super. And thanks for sharing a little bit of your own experiences as well. And
light up the blog, y'all. Check it out, boundless.org.
Thanks, everyone.
Just one thing I've got to pass along, 'cause I know that it will help you in the journey you're on. You see, I've learned from disappointment and in all my broken dreams that God in all His mercy is looking out for me. 'Cause in the heart of a man He makes His plans, but the Lord
welcome to this week's culture segment. I am joined on the phone by a very fun guy. I've had the chance to talk to him already. His name is Steve Saccone. Steve, welcome.
Thank you very much. Good to be with all of you listening today.
Woo-hoo. Well, great to have you as a first-time guest here on The Boundless Show. For those of you who don't know Steve, he is, I guess you're part of Mosaic, right? You're still out of L.A.
Yes.
Down there, and you're a campus pastor. And you also work for Gallup, which many people know, you know, the work that that Gallup does, the Gallup organization, and you are a professor for Golden Gate Seminary. So
that's right.
You have an MA in transformational leadership, which I don't even know what in the world that is. You're going to have to tell us. And you are the author of Relational Intelligence, RI, a book, and the subtitle says How Leaders Can Expand Their Influence Through a New Way of Being Smart. And that is what we're going to talk about today, because this week's theme here on the show, we're kind of dealing with everything from friendship and the idea of community to relationships and how we make it all work, and what that looks like to be an influencer in the midst of all of that. So very appropriate, I think, what you've written about as far as dealing with that. So and obviously your schooling has brought to bear on that, as well as some of the things that you do now. So I wanted to kick off by addressing something that you do in the book, and you actually call it the Michael Scott syndrome. Those who are familiar with the show The Office, I'm sure most of our audience is. And it's kind of what I summarize as a lack of self-awareness. And we know that he is very funny on the show because he's most often non-self-aware. And it provides for a lot of humor, but in real life situations, it can be anything but humorous. So tell us how no one sets out in life to be not self-aware. So how does this come about, and why is it so problematic?
Yeah, first off, if you're a fan of The Office, you may be grieving with me because Steve Carell is leaving the show. So moment of silence. But the show, of course, is funny because Michael Scott is the most relationally unintelligent person we could all imagine. But I think part of why it's funny, which has to do with self-awareness, is a lot of us know someone like that, maybe in a less exaggerated way, but we've had a boss or a friend or a roommate or, you know, someone in our life that lacks enough self-awareness that people around them are like, really? Did he just say that? Or did he just do that? And if we don't know somebody like that, we probably are that person. But that being said, you know, I think all of us, as human beings, have to go on a journey of increasing our levels of awareness when it comes to relationships. Because the reality is we all have different blind spots of sorts when it comes to how we relate to other people. If we're honest, we probably all said something we shouldn't have, or, you know, regretted, you know, an interaction and just kind of walked away going, man, that was awkward. Why did I say that? Or why did he or why did she say that? Or, so I think part of this journey of becoming relationally intelligent is choosing an intentional path of increasing our self-awareness, because the way I kind of think of it is we all have a little bit of Michael Scott in, whether we like to admit it or not, meaning we all have some blind spots. We all have, you know, contradicted ourselves or said something we shouldn't have. So we all have a little bit in that somewhere. So that's kind of a starting point.
Yeah. So if you had to actually define relational intelligence, then tell us what it is and what it is not.
Yeah, you know, sometimes people ask me what relational intelligence is, and a lot of times it's first easier to know what it's not, because people think, oh, you have to be an extrovert to be relationally intelligent, or you have to be charismatic, or some of the contrarians sort of say to me, they'll challenge me, and they'll say, isn't becoming relationally intelligent really another form of manipulation, you know, and people trying to get what they want? And in some sense, yeah, if you become more relationally intelligent, you can become more manipulative, you know, and that's why when I talk about relational intelligence, there's a posture and essence that's behind it that is serving oriented toward people, that has a humility behind it. So to me, relational intelligence is at its core navigating interpersonal dynamics in a smart way and in a way that values people. Mm-hmm. So it's about serving people. It's about caring for people. It's about sometimes knowing when to be bold and kind of offer tough love, and other times offer tender love. It's learning to navigate those moments in better ways. And it involves things like, you know, increasing the energy of a conversation when a conversation is sort of dead or stalled out. It involves adding meaning or significance to your conversations in life, or establishing deeper trust or deeper connection, which we all long for, you know, as human beings. Relational intelligence involves becoming more likable and learning how do you become more likable. We all probably would say we're likable, but the reality is some of us sometimes have unlikable tendencies, and again, that ties back to self-awareness. If we don't become aware of what those tendencies are, we actually don't become relationally intelligent like we think we might be.
Yeah. Well, I know probably a lot of people are sitting here going, oh my goodness, what he just said is totally exhausting. And don't you ever have people tell you, you know, well, you know, Steve, don't you just have it or you don't? I mean, how can you really improve those kinds of things in yourself? Or how can you even be aware enough to identify them and know that you can grow in them? It seems like it's one of the, you know, whenever people write fiction or especially romance novels, it's always the brooding hero that has all this relational intelligence and, you know, then just mocks everyone else that doesn't have it. But, you know, because a lot of people will say, well, you know, that's I can't do that. She has that because she's just so naturally nice, or they're just naturally gifted or naturally witty, or they just know what to say at the right time. And so how can we really cultivate this in ourselves?
Yeah, well, I think there's good news and bad news. The good news is, I think we all have aspects of relational intelligence. I mean, almost every person I've ever met has certain dimensions of relational intelligence. So in some sense, that's the good news. The bad news, I guess you could call it, is there are always ways that we need to, I think, improve our relational intelligence. And relational intelligence in every person doesn't always look the same. There's a sense of it being, of it looking as much like you as, you know, your talents and strengths and gifts might look, you know, unique to you. So I can talk about, you know, the different sort of principles of relational intelligence or core ideas of relational intelligence that I think we all can grow in, but it doesn't mean we all look the same. In other words, it's not all of our pursuit to become extroverted. Mm-hmm. So if an introvert who becomes relational intelligent is going to look different than, you know, flaming extrovert, you know, who is relational intelligence, and interactions look different, and we all have different tendencies, and we have to live in these different tensions so that we can actually get better at this. So no matter what our personality, no matter what our talent, it's not that we aspire to all be the same level of wittiness or the same level of extroversion or the same level of becoming a great question asker. It's that we have to look at ourselves into who God has created us to be uniquely, and then grow in the areas that are, you know, maybe have some deficits in them when it comes to relational intelligence. So in some sense, it's daunting if you look at the whole and say, oh, I have to become this perfect relationally intelligent person, but I don't think that's really the goal. The goal is to engage the journey and to improve in different areas where it could make us better relationally and have deeper connection and build trust in greater ways. And that looks different for each person.
Yeah. So what are some signs that we can identify, you know, that would show us that our relational intelligence needs work, or on which areas would we need to work? Other than someone saying, you remind me a lot of Michael Scott.
Yeah.
Probably wouldn't be the best.
Well, you know, I think some of this goes back to the dilemma that we all face of who we're inviting into our life to be honest and truthful with us. Mm-hmm. Because the reality is that there's lots of different layers of relational intelligence, and too many of us, and I've lived here too many of us, hold people out of our life, so to speak. We may not say it directly, but in some sense, we almost resist other people, you know, saying something to us that could help us in a relational component of our life, you know. And so we keep people at enough distance away, but where it hurts us is because we never totally know the true picture of how we interact with people. I mean, this is really obvious, I think, in dating circles, and we've probably all seen this before. I mean, I've been part of a church that's average age is 25, and there's lots of singles, and they start dating, and, you know, and all that whole world. And what happens inevitably is when someone starts dating, two people start dating, and they, you know, fall for each other more or less, the stronger their love becomes for each other, so to speak, the tendency is the less open they are to other people's input and feedback. Mm-hmm. And so I see often young relationships that are, you know, that everyone around them sees sort of the obvious, you know, some kind of foolishness or some kind of really weird thing about their relationship, except those people, you know, and so they live in denial. And that's just one example of many. We do it outside of dating relationships too. You know, we keep people at a distance. And I think that's where it begins, that we have relationships of honesty in our life, and we actually initiate those, and we actually invite people into that space of our lives to be honest with us about perhaps our relational deficits, you know, and literally it's asking people who we've built trust and connection and relationship with, asking them how we can improve in the way we relate to people, you mm-hmm. know. So quick example, you know, some of us have tendencies toward always listening in conversations or social settings. Others of us have tendencies of being more of the talker, right? And neither are inherently bad. But it's important that you know what your tendencies are, because on the one hand, if you're the talker, you don't want to be the dominator of conversation where everyone knows you dominate every conversation and it's like always you talking, or maybe it's you always, you know, doing self-promotion, you know, and you don't even realize it, but everyone else that you interact with does realize it, you know. Or the listener, right, the person who never adds anything to the conversation on the other side of it, you know, that's a relationally unintelligent form too, because you're not actually establishing often greater trust and greater relationship because you're not actually talking in the conversation, right? Mm-hmm. And in some sense, it's noble or honorable to listen to people and you care more about them, but in another sense, you have to, I think it's a healthy thing to actually add to a conversation and be part of it in an engaged way. So that's just one example.
Yeah, no, that's true. I mean, even now I'm thinking, you know, I think I go in extremes. Sometimes I'll sit in a large meeting and I just won't say anything. And then everyone's like, how come you're not saying anything? And other times I talk so much and I literally stop and I say, I'm just exhausted from the sheer volume of words I've just said. And so it's just a matter of like gauging that, you know? And I'm like, why am I still talking? Like, why is my voice just echoing in my ears, you know? And then other people are just like kind of looking at me with glazed eyes. So,
yeah.
Oh, I know you find that hard to believe, but it's true, Steve. It's true. So, okay, so you talk... thanks. You'll probably write me a personal note saying, here are your relational intelligence issues. Please work on them. I will receive that from you. Don't worry. You feel free to write it. Okay, you talk in the book, and I want you to use a couple of these examples to illustrate a couple points. You refer to what you call the six roles of a relational genius, and you kind of have these different personas or kind of roles, I guess, of how people really maximize relational intelligence for especially leadership and influence. So give us a couple of those just so people can get an understanding of things that they can look towards improving in areas that may be strengths for them.
Yeah. Yeah. One role of what I call a relational genius would be called a story collector. Mm-hmm. And it's built off the idea that every person's life is a story being told. It's an unfolding, you know, drama, if you will. And so the people that we interact with, especially if we want to have influence over them, their life is telling a story. And part of being relational intelligent is actually getting to know that story. And I'm not just talking about their faith story. I'm talking about their personhood, their life history, their passions, their dreams, you know, all of who they are. And so part of being relational intelligent is discovering what story their life is telling, right, which involves being interested in their life. It involves developing the art of good question asking, where they actually are invited to open up their life and share with you, which often, you know, it's a simple concept, but often we don't do with other people. We don't take time to slow down and really ask and really care. I mean, we've probably all been at some point on the other side of that conversation where someone's been with us and they ask us questions. I've had this happen to me, where you just feel like that person is more interested in you than anybody else in the world. Mm-hmm. And I never met Mother Teresa, but that was her reputation, as it's written, that actually when she was interacting with you, you felt like you were the most important person in the world with her, you mm-hmm. know? And some people, again, are naturally really good at that, and other people have to work harder at it. But I think it is a good goal for all of us to become a better story collector. Second example is what I call an energy carrier. It's someone who changes the tone or the temperature of a room, right? And we've all been in those rooms that, you know, have maybe either a negative energy, you know, and someone comes into the room and they sort of change the tone of that environment, you know. And I think that really starts on the inside and works its way outside, where you actually bring your full self to a moment, so you're attuned to the energy in the room, and you can do things that sort of affect it, you know, because we all have the capacity, right, to add to it or to take away from an environment, you know. Mm-hmm. And I'll just give you one more. Is what I call a conversational futurist, which might sound like a superhero, but it's sort of the opposite of what I also sometimes jokingly call a conversational backtracker, which is somebody who sometimes stalls out a conversation, right, or they slow down a conversation. A conversation is going a certain direction, right, which is what conversational futurists do. They take it forward, right, or they help a person move forward. Mm-hmm. So a real quick example, I was talking to someone one time. They were telling me about how this guy had broke up with them, and they were sort of venting about it and kind of had a negative sort of thing going on about that guy. And it was one of those moments that I sensed out, okay, this person has actually become really embittered toward this guy. Now, it was probably, you know, it's always a two-way street in some sense, you know. And so I just asked the question, you know, I said, hey, it seems like you're not really taking responsibility for maybe how you may have caused this breakup, you know, in that kind of situation without getting into the details. It was one of those moments that it helped this person move out of her sort of bitterness and say, start to move towards saying, okay, I need to take some responsibility for this too. What is my responsibility, and how do I move toward forgiving him? You know, which that's what a conversational futurist does. And there's a skill set you learn, I think, that can help you get better at that. And again, I think everybody can actually get better at that, even though some people are more natural at it than others.
Yeah, that's good. And I think by identifying those different, those different roles, it kind of gives people a picture of, oh, yeah, because everyone, as you were relating those, said, oh, I've totally been in that situation, or I've been in a room where that's happened, or I hate it when someone comes and talks to me and they're, you know, sucking the life out of me or being so down or so bitter. So you talk here specifically about, and I alluded to this, about influence. And I know when we talk to young adults, there's kind of this impression, not only among young adults, but probably among those in older generations, that you have to earn your stripes and that maturity comes with age and a lot of different stereotypes about that. But you probably would argue that young leaders can use relational intelligence to gain influence and really to showcase maybe some of their own talents and strengths while at the same time learning from others in the process. How could that happen, would you say?
Yeah. Well, I think a distinct thing about younger generations is that relationships often, especially in the workplace, so to speak, relationships actually seem to be at least as important and perhaps in some cases more important. And so, in other words, what I mean by that, people just don't want a boss. Mm-hmm. People want a boss they can actually relate to. People want a boss, and research shows this too, people want a boss who actually cares about them at some level. Now, it doesn't mean they have to care about, you know, every single detail of their life. But actually, people are increasingly wanting that in their life. In fact, there's a guy that wrote a book called Three Signs of a Miserable Job, and one of the signs of a miserable job is anonymity. Hmm. And essentially, he says, like, we want to be known, you know, and that's a real part of relationships. I think we have to, like, lean into that, in a sense, when it comes to influence, right? That the more we get to know people, the more we ask questions, the more we actually take time to be interested in their life, the more influence we can, you know, establish with them. And I think they're simple things. I mean, another role of relational genius I talk about is what I call the likable hero. And a simple way to understand this is, I remember when I was in college, when I was in a big buddy program for a junior high school, and I sort of became a mentor to this, you know, 12-year-old kid. And I hung out with him a couple times. And from the very beginning, I realized how much he admired me. And I hadn't done anything really to earn his trust and credibility other than I hung out with him and he liked me. And in some sense, I became a hero to him, you know, because he liked me, you know, and there wasn't that much more to it than that. And I know that's a simple idea, but I think adult to adult, we don't give enough validity to that same reality. And I think even in our generation, likability goes a long ways. I mean, I think likability happens to actually produce trust a lot faster than other things sometimes that we think build trust, like time, right? Like a seasoned, experienced leader. Because I don't think we always necessarily need that. Now, likability is, you know, a little bit dangerous, because if someone has high likability but say they don't have good character, and then someone starts trusting them, obviously that's a dangerous path. Yeah. But on the other side of it, if you have likability with character and you begin to use your likability to serve someone else and actually to gain influence, you can actually establish it really fast. And, you know, one of the things I did at our church called Mosaic is something called the Protégé Program. I started it when I was 26 years old, I think, and had all these 20-somethings enter this leadership program, the two-year leadership program. And what surprised me, quite honestly, is the people that started to put trust in me so quickly, or sometimes it took 6 months or a year, and there's different levels of that, but I learned quickly that it wasn't about age and it wasn't even about experience. Those things can be valuable, but they don't have to be inherently there for someone to start actually trusting you and giving influence, you know, in their life.
Yeah, no, so true. And I think we see that play out so often in the job market, too, where people are just looking at resumes and degrees and grade point averages. And I had this conversation kind of jokingly with my brother-in-law, because he was bragging about his IQ, that it came in at the genius level. And then he had me take the test and I came in at, like, you know, under, to be like 20 points under him or something. And I remember saying to him, well, I'm glad that I'm just smart enough, you know, to have some smarts, but still have social skills. So I gave him a hard time. I said that was the trade-off, you know, is that he was just this brilliant genius, but, you know, I had some social skills. So really looking at it in balance, like you said, and being able to understand and see people and obviously use your gifts in a way that maximizes the situation for yourself and for others in the midst of all that, I think is huge. So
yeah,
that's cool. Well, Steve, thank you so much. This has been fascinating. Again, I want to remind folks, the book is called RI, Relational Intelligence, How Leaders Can Expand Their Influence Through a New Way of Being Smart. We've been talking to Steve Saccone. Great to hear from you, Steve. This is a very interesting book, and I'm sure it will be helpful to our folks out there. Write to us if you pick up a copy of the book. Everyone write to us at editor@boundless.org and let us know what you think, or maybe you can weigh in with your own kind of quirky stories that you've had to deal with as far as relational intelligence, or maybe a little aha moment that you had even during this interview about something that you could work on to possibly be more relational and smarter in your relationships, I guess, really. So, Steve, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, and if anybody wants to take a relational intelligence assessment, they could actually go to relationalintelligence.org, and there's a free assessment there. You can also get a free chapter, which is the chapter on Michael Scott syndrome. So have at it. Go to relationalintelligence.org and get it.
Excellent. And we will link to that on the blog as well, so folks can get that. So take the assessment. Let us know what your results were. Maybe we can help one another along this path. So, Steve, thanks again so much for this conversation.
Yeah, thanks, everybody.
All I've got, all I am, all my dreams, all my plans, I'm holding back, I'm holding nothing back from you. All I've got, all I am, all my dreams, all my plans, I'm holding back, I'm holding nothing back from you.
Everyone, we are opening up this week's inbox, and I'm actually solo in the studio this week. Martha, I guess, asked me to answer this question as it pertains to online dating. Apparently, I'm the expert. Not that it's brought much success so far, but who knows? So anyway, but it's a great question. So hopefully I'll be able to weigh in just based on some of my experience and what has gone down. So here we go. This writer says, I've just joined an online dating site because I don't meet a lot of men in my career or church. I've been contacted by quite a few men on the site and exchanged messages with some of them discussing hobbies, churches, and other sorts of things you would usually talk about upon a first meeting with someone. However, once we've covered our most obvious areas of commonality, I'm not sure where the relationship should go. After two or three messages, we aren't well enough acquainted to really know whether a relationship is a serious possibility. But likewise, we are past the most obvious lighthearted points of conversation, and taking things any deeper would require an obvious effort at asking more personal questions. Should I wait for the guy to ask the deeper questions and move our conversation from hobbies and general interests to social life, family, and values? Or can I start asking questions myself? Or should we just go ahead and meet in person? I don't want to come across as being uninterested or unavailable, an impression which some people have suggested I give off and which I'm trying to overcome. Well, obviously, this is a great question and one that is very common, will probably apply to a lot of people because so many people are online at some point in their dating experience these days, so it seems. So I've had kind of two seasons of being online. I did a good solid year of it a little while back, and then actually am online a little bit in the fray right now for a couple things we're doing here at Boundless, as well as just my own edification, I guess, or maybe just self-inflicted torture. But I definitely, and you've heard me express opinions about online dating on the show before, and I will restate them generally, and that is online dating, we think here at Boundless, is just fine. It's a way of, I always say, getting your numbers up and a way to meet people. It's just a great opportunity to use a tool that we have now, which is technology to meet people. And I think it's become maybe in some ways a little bit more difficult to meet people. So nothing wrong with that. However, there are definitely some precautions in online dating because it can become, I think, a little bit consumeristic, and it can become kind of an opportunity for people to hold out for something that maybe doesn't exist. And because this constant churn of opportunity comes through, you can become a little bit unrealistic, I think, in your expectations. So to your question specifically, I think it's interesting because, yeah, the way it plays out is usually there's some kind of contact. Either you're matched with someone or you have the opportunity to contact someone. And just to get to the point, really, with your question, I will say I don't think there's anything wrong with asking questions back and forth, whether male or female, whoever initiates that. I mean, the whole point is you're kind of online. You are via the computer screen, almost conducting kind of a first date. You're going to ask questions. You're going to find out a little bit more about that person. You're going to need to know a few things about that person because, as you do know, having been online, sometimes people's profiles are very sketchy or people just don't know how to craft good profiles. And so you really can't get a complete picture of a person sometimes by their profile. So you were asking specifically, as a female, what's your responsibility and really what should you do? Where should you wait? Where should you initiate? And like I said, I mean, going in there, asking questions, getting to know a person, totally legit. You would do that if you were sitting across the table from him drinking coffee. Now, ideally, you're going to want this guy to be a person who wants to ask those kinds of questions himself. Obviously, you've covered some of the banter. And really, it is one of those things where you say, where do I go from here? Because honestly, you don't want to be sitting being this guy's pen pal for 3 years. And we know that that has happened online as well. So someone has got to show some initiative here. We're going to hope that it's him. And we're going to hope that he has a game plan for his online dating where he is being intentional. He knows that he's in it to win it. He knows what's going down. And he's got some direction. Start looking for that initially. I mean, hopefully that, this guy is going to show evidence of that. And if he does, then you're going to see that this might be a guy to consider and to pay attention to. Now, if he doesn't, it can be something where maybe he's shy or he doesn't want to seem too pushy or he doesn't want to be an online stalker. And who knows, maybe other women online have said to him, hey, you're just moving too fast. Why are you asking me about this? So it's not like you need to write him off. But I would definitely move in that direction of just throwing out a question then that goes a little bit deeper. I don't think there's anything wrong with that at all. And hopefully that will kind of prompt him to say, okay, she is comfortable with this. That does demonstrate a good level of, of comfort with who I am and with getting to know me a little bit more. And maybe he'll start initiating some questions that he finds to be interesting or that he wants to get to know you in regards to. So I think that would be good as well. Now, this you did not ask in your question, but I'm just going to address it anyway because I feel it's kind of the next logical step. And that is eventually this does have to move towards a meeting. I mean, this is not about just getting to know this guy until you feel you could marry him after just getting to know him online. A lot of problems arise from that. In fact, an emotional intimacy can build that becomes a little bit artificial. And then when you do get to meet, I've heard people that have conducted their entire dating relationship online and then they just show up somewhere and marry the person. That is not okay, people. I just don't think it's okay. So I would definitely say that, this guy should be moving towards eventually saying, hey, I've gotten to know some things about you. I think we'd be a good fit. Let's meet. I would hope that this guy, if you're in the U.S., this guy isn't in Sri Lanka. I mean, there's kind of some issues related to that with some long distance stuff. That can get a little bit sketchy. Obviously, you need to be doing this in community as well. But I would say move towards that meeting. And if he does not eventually get there, and I'm not saying I'm putting a time limit on it, but there has to be some like, hey, where's this going to go? Then you're going to eventually have to press that point. And it's almost the online pulling a Ruth. Sorry about having to make that an online version of that. But I think you're in a good place right now. I think obviously this is early on in the relationship. It looks like what has progressed is totally normal from everything that I've seen so far. And it is really, it's like, you know, you would go out to coffee for a few times, get to know this person. Make sure that you are observing and examining the objective points of this relationship as well. Do not get so caught up in this guy's witty banter that you're overlooking facts in his profile or things that he does say that should be red flags. So again, I think that's why bringing someone else into this, having them evaluate the situation, having them meet him as well eventually is going to help you in the long run. So go for it. Keep us posted on what happens, and hopefully we'll be able to be with you for part of that journey. So thanks so much. That is it, everyone, for this week's Inbox. I am your host, Lisa Anderson. We want to hear from you. Please do write to us, editor@boundless.org, so we can hear from you in the future, answer your questions, get to know you a little bit better, and of course, hear your success stories along the way. So that is it for this week's show. I'm your host, Lisa Anderson, for The Boundless Show.
The Boundless Show is a production of boundless.org. Focus on the family.